too much?
Oh, no, no, it's going very well, I think, and I'm glad you're revealing the mixture of experiences you had in the research you were doing, because that's the way, of course, research really goes. Let me ask you about your movement during this time into research management. You have indicated a little bit about it, but can you give any more details about what appealed to you, your management style?
Well, I guess I was never sure whether I was really management or not. I liked certain aspects of management, but obviously I enjoyed the research end. But I thought I really wanted to give management a try, and in 1966 I got that opportunity, and so I took it, and I managed the group actually that I had been working in, and so I was responsible for really the tech service of the PTA. We did the R&D did the tech service on PTA, the quality problems. So, and if there were any manufacturing problems, we worked with our manufacturing people. So I was responsible for that. And it was a great experience because I went along with the marketing people to our customers, and we went R&D and marketing, sat down and tried to resolve whatever problems came up. And we were always very honest with our customers about what went on. And our customers, even though sometimes our customers didn't believe we were being honest with them, we would tell them what was going on and could try to work to solve the problems. And I think in the end, working with our customers that closely gave R&D a very good picture of what our customers needed in way product quality. And it turns out it isn't absolute quality that's as important as having the same quality all the time. Because the real problem with polyester quality was in the dyeing of the material. Or even the white shirt, the eye can perceive fairly small changes going from white to a little bit yellowish and back. And what was really dramatic in some of our customers' cases was when they put dye into the material. They could have red dye at times, and the same material, same threads, apparently would come out looking light pink. And so constant quality between both the PTA quality and the way that the polyester manufacturer made his material was really very important in working with them. And I think by being honest with our customers, we developed a high degree of credibility and mostly a very good working relationship with our customers. Matter of fact, we spent a lot of time working on setting the specifications for PTA when we started. And one of the people that we dealt with, my marketing colleague, told me one day, to know him is to hate him. Well, I got to know him later on, and it turns out that he really was a pretty nice guy, but he was just being tough. And when we set those requirements, and the specifications, they stayed until just a few years ago when we got both better analytical techniques and techniques for making the polymer and finding out really what chemistry was important, what impurities were important in making polymer and so on. So that those specifications, although they were derived at in what I would call maybe struggling negotiations. By being tough with us, he created, I think, specifications which were very good for us and for the industry, and they held up for a very long time, and mostly they're still in place. Let's see, I got diverted back,
I was just asking about your management experiences, and that's part of it. Anything else to add to your portion of your career when you were in management?
Well, after I'd been in this field for about, I guess it was 71, so that would be 6 years. I had spent from 55 to 71 essentially in the same field. I'd also worked with our development of our trimolytic anhydride technology, and I'd done some with our isophthalic technology, but mostly it was with purified terephthalic acid and trimolytic anhydride. And I decided maybe it was time to do something different, and so I asked my boss if there was an opening in an area where they were working on developmental products. And I said, you know, would you like to consider me for that position? And so it was a sideways move, and he was very anxious to do it, and so we made that move. And then I spent most of the rest of my career just working on new product development, exploratory research, that kind of thing.
Tell us something about that. What particular product development were you most associated with?
Well, nothing that I worked with actually ever became commercialized. And I think partly it was because Amoco was growing so fast with the products they had that nobody was very interested in taking the risks of going with new products. And I think the other thing that was a problem was that the relationship between the marketing people that we were supposed to be supporting and us was less than satisfactory. They would be very encouraging at the start of a project, and about halfway through, just when you were starting to spend big money on it, they would say, "Oh, I don't think we know about this yet." They really hadn't done their homework. I guess I shouldn't really talk too much about that. It just was a... We never got a team work together that really said what we ought to be doing. Management, I think, on the other hand, upper management, really wanted us to come up with new products. And they kept giving us money to spend as long as we came up with ideas. And R&D was coming up with lots of ideas, but the business and the marketing aspects of them had not been tested fully enough, I think. But they didn't say no, and so management kept giving us more opportunity to do things. And so we had a lot of fun, and we had a lot of successful research that was unsuccessful from a commercial standpoint, which is one thing that just drives you nuts when you're in that business, because you don't just want to have successful technical research, you want your research to go commercial. That's really the reason you're in business in the industrial atmosphere. And after I had spent a fair number of years there, as a matter of fact, I became a director. We grew from, I think we started out, we had about four people, and we probably grew to 120 professionals in doing that kind of work. I had decided that I really wasn't cut out to manage that kind of work the way they wanted it managed. And so I asked to get back to the technical ladder, and they moved me back to the technical ladder for my last 2.5 years, which was a lot of fun, really, because I could talk to scientists and advise them from a technical standpoint. And once they realized I wasn't part of management anymore, then they finally would start talking to me, and not everybody would open up, but they were enough opened up, so it was a very enjoyable thing. And in addition, I looked at lots of, not lots, but a number of technologies from outside Amoco and evaluated them for the company to see whether we ought to pick them up or not, working with government labs, universities, and that kind of thing.
Was there any particular project during that last 2.5 years that you enjoyed above others?
Well, yeah, we had a project on making pyrometal styrene going, and one of the problems in dehydrogenation was that you could get isopropyl styrene, which was really bad, costly, and that sort of thing. And I found a way of selectively hydrogenating that material and getting rid of it. So it gave me the sense that after 20-some years in management, I could still go back to R&D and do it. So that, from that standpoint, it was very desirable, enjoyable.
Well, Amoco chose to recognize and honor your career with an award, I believe. Tell us something about that.
Well, in 1989, the VP of research invited me out to lunch one day, and I had a meeting that afternoon that I had to make a presentation at, so he had asked me if I wanted a drink with the meal, and I said no. I said, I gotta give a talk this afternoon, I said. And he sat down and told me that the company was going to honor me with an award, which, you know, well, that's nice. And then he's told me that they were also going to give me $150,000, and Amoco had never given anybody that I knew of that kind of money for anything. And he looked at me and he says, I thought I should have encouraged you. I got drink. But they did. They had a nice award party, and it was a fun bash.
I'm sure it was. What was the name of the award?
William M. Burton Award. Mr. Burton was the person responsible for developing cracking of hydrocarbons to gasoline and kerosene. And he and Humphreys, I think, was kind of the, whether they were co-inventors or what, but they had been responsible for this cracking material. And they were the last people that had gotten an award like this from the company. And that was probably in the, in the teens or 20 or something like that. And so I'm really the only person in the company that's gotten this award so far. And they're looking, I guess, for other people now that are deserving of the award.
And you received another major recognition from President Bush, I believe.
Yeah, I got the National Medal of Technology from Department of Commerce, and it was handed out by President Bush in the Rose Garden, and I think that was 92. And that was an experience. That was a 3-day bash, and they allowed us only two guests, so we had 5 children, and so it was kind of difficult to make a choice on which of the 2 of the 5 we should invite along, but we invited the 2 boys who were kind of in the chemistry field, and we all had a good time in Washington.
Well, as a result of your experience with Amoco, you spent your entire career with one company, very happy choice for you there at the beginning of your career. As a result of your experience with it, what does scientific innovation mean to you?
Well, I think you need to have a need for a product in the marketplace. I think it was one of the most important things. Early when we were, before we had even heard of scientific designs technology, we had Dr. Herman Mark as a consultant. And he had pointed out to us that from all the synthetic fibers, that polyester was the best combination, had the best combination of properties to be a successful synthetic fiber. So we started out, I think, with the idea that here was a product that, if you could make it right, was going to be a successful product. And then we had the raw materials. We had a management commitment. John Swearingen had said he wanted the company to be 10% of the chemicals to be 10% of the Amoco Corporation's income by 1970. This was in the mid, let's see, he became chairman about 1957 or 8, somewhere like that. So it gave us 12 years to go from 50 million to 2 billion every minute. So I think you need to have the right kind of marketplace. You've got to have a vision of what that product is going to be, and then you have to have the means to make it. I think you have to have a marketing group that works with the customers to find out what the customers really need, and to then make the product that they need, not the product you want to make necessarily. And then you've got to price the materials such that the be able to price them such that the end consumer will buy them and use them.
And the company still makes some profit.
Oh yes, yes. You gotta have that profit margin in there. Otherwise, you give up on it. The question is, you know, in our case, these were really terrific unknowns. I think one of the other things is the willingness to take risks is so important, and I see that as a very difficult thing for corporate managers today. There's so much heat from the Wall Street people that it's difficult for a chairman or president of a subsidiary or anything to make a decision to go with new technology that hasn't been proven and where there isn't a market proven. In our case, you know, we went 6 months after the invention was made. We made the decision to be commercial and what technology we were going to use. We hadn't done the pilot planning. We made the pilot, built the pilot plants and had them running shortly after and showed indeed that the technology would work. But I think you've got to have the ability and the willingness to take the risks. The ability, you've got to be able to lose the money and not go broke. One company did that. They went with technology and it didn't work and they went broke. You know, they just overextended themselves. So you've got to be able to take the risks. And then I think you've got to have faith that things are going to work out and the commitment to make things work if they can work.
You made reference a little earlier in discussing the latter part of your career to scientific teamwork, and it was implied in much earlier in your description of your career. What's your comments about scientific teamwork in an industrial environment?
Well, there's no question in my mind that without it, things don't work. At least they work extremely difficultly. Now we have all kinds of organization techniques to try to set up situations so that you do indeed have teamwork. I think basically all these things do is try to emulate what we did back in those early days. You know, we were a small group of people. There were three scientists, one design engineer in research. There were probably three people in marketing. And then the associated management people, that was our team. And we also knew that if we didn't get with PTA, Amoco Chemical may not survive. And so there was a strong desire to make this thing work. And based on that, people just worked together. And it wasn't that there weren't at times some rubbing of the edges of personalities, but everybody realized that we wanted to work together to make this thing go. And I know from an R&D standpoint, we would do anything that marketing asked to make the project a success, or that engineering asked. And so I think the new techniques now that they've got for management are really trying to get these sorts of ideals into the people and the systems that are being involved. I think one of the problems that I see now is that it seems like on most of the projects where I've looked recently, you don't have small teams anymore. You have major teams, like teams of 20 and 30 and maybe 40 people trying to bring out a new project. And it is really difficult to get all of these people working together and trying to do the same thing. But I think it's important and essential that they do. Excuse me.
Okay. I'm sure that you engage in a good bit of what would be called professional networking, both within the company and perhaps outside the company during your career. Do you have any particular recollection or comments about that?
Well, certainly as far as inside the company, you develop friendship with an awful lot of people over a career that went as far as mine and the kind of thing that I did. And so I got to know a lot of people, and I used them and vice versa. And that was important. Externally, not really. I probably didn't do nearly as much networking as might have been good for me. I did develop some good friendships on the outside, but a very limited amount.
Uh-huh. Were there any significant changes in the R&D support during your career?
I don't know what you're...
Well, was there any upper management decisions that affected the R&D? You indicated, I think, that there was a continual flow of monetary support for your work.
Okay.
But,
yes, well, in the early days, in the 50s, Amoco Corporation Chemical Company was formed in 57 as a subsidiary of the Standard Oil. And in the early part of the commercialization of the oxidation technology, we were losing big amounts of money. And in 1962, Amoco was also trying to, Standard Oil was also trying to develop overseas presence in the oil production and refining area. And they were losing money there too. And I think it was sometime in 62, we got together one day and the vice president said that a third of you are going to be laid off by 4:30 this afternoon, and you'll all know what your position is. And we didn't think too much about it until we got up to the lab, and I was standing there with two of my colleagues, and we said, that's one out of three. And in those days, it wasn't a bad deal because there were lots of job opportunities available for scientists, and most of the people got equal or better positions within 90 days of the time we were laid off. So that was one shot we had, and it brought us down to really a very small department, and it was probably the most productive time in my career as far as the department, because we had we had essentially let go of all the young people and some of the people who weren't producing. So we had really very effective people working in the group. And things pretty well, they didn't go straight then from then on, but, you know, gradually up until, I guess, the late 1980s, when restructuring became the name of the game. And so from then on until now, there have been big decreases in the number of people in the R&D department. Well, we grew at a very rapid rate from 1970 to about 1985. And so we had hired a lot of people, and I have to admit that sometimes we were hiring more people than I thought was logical for the kind of organization we had and for what we were attempting to do. But I guess when management allows you to hire people, you have a tendency to walk into that question too much.
Did most of those hires that you felt might have been excessive stay with the company, or did a downsizing occur subsequently?
Well, a lot of when the downsizing came, it was a lot of it was done by retirement, early retirement, and so on. But I guess I don't really know what the percentage, but a lot of people did get let go that we had hired, I thought were. And I don't know enough about the organization right now to know whether, you know, whether they're back into the range. I think they're probably back into the range that I think they should be.
Would you like to pause to get a drink of water?
I think I'll take a cough.
What would you say is important for the future of chemical R&D?
Well, I think probably the most important thing is that they know really what the direction of the organization they're in is going. You need to know what is needed by management and what kind of projects they will really think are great if you are successful. It's my belief that if you told management in a conceptual stage of definition the kind of project you were talking about, that they would not, at this stage, be willing to support that project. So you have to develop your projects where you think you've got, you need to make some basic, do some basic, what I call basic research, getting the understanding, getting the pieces of technology together that would allow for a commercialization. You've got to do that at the as least expensive a way as you can, and get the definition of the technology and work very closely with the marketing people to get the definition of the product pinpointed early in the game. But I think the other thing is you've got to recognize what risks your management is going to take. And you always can dream that they're going to take risks outside of the level that they have demonstrated they're willing to take, but it really doesn't happen very often. So you need to know that. And you shouldn't be working on projects, I think, that don't come in with that risk level. The other thing I think is there is a tendency of people to want to commercialize very fast, and I understand that because the sooner you get commercialized, the sooner you start making money. But in doing that, you sometimes spend money up front for development of technology that isn't desirable technology. And then you have to go back and do it over. So I think you need to be very wise at choosing when you've got the right technology to go commercial with. And not put the development money in until you've got that done. I know sometimes you think you've got the right technology and you don't, and that's all right. Because you will make mistakes, you know, if you're not taking risks if you don't make some mistakes now and then. But I think you need to be working carefully with your marketing and your engineering people to know that you've got all the pieces put in together. That if you're working on a new product, that you've got the right product qualities, properties defined. And one of those qualities is always cost of making the product. So you need to have all those things pretty well understood. And then you need to work on the things that are most important first to, you know, set your priorities straight.
You made some reference to the concerns of the financial persons in the industry about product development. Do you think that given the situation in today's industry that the projects that you successfully worked on would have been approved and supported today in the situation that you found then and now?
Probably not, because we took some what would be considered today big risks, and because we hadn't demonstrated everything, we hadn't dotted every T and crossed every T and dotted every I. Matter of fact, we hadn't even come close. I think, looking back, what made us successful is that we had developed very sound basic understanding of the science that we were working with. We had the physical property data very clearly in hand, and we had the chemical weight data in hand. And with that, and using good sound chemical engineering judgment, then we were able to take some of these risks, and they did work. They were within close enough proximity that you could adjust. For instance, the DMT process also went directly from these little sealed tubes I was talking to you about to a continuous commercial process without the pilot plant in between. And it turned out that once we finally, I don't know, it was maybe 5 or 6 years after we commercialized the technology, one of our plants actually operated precisely at the rates that we set. Now, the thing that kept us from doing that all along was that the catalyst was insoluble and would precipitate out and fill up the reactor, so our reactors would get smaller as we went along, and so we'd have to clean them out every now and then. And that process actually reduced the productivity of the reactors. But I think if you do that, and you ask yourself, "Is what's going to kill you?" and you make sure that you don't have anything in there that'll kill you if you have screwed up, that things will go. But I agree, in this day and age, people would not take the kind of risks that we took.
And yet, that risk, in this case, was very productive. Paid off well.
Yep, that's, today it's one of Amoco Corporation's major profit makers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what the percentage of Amoco's profits are that are derived from it, but it's enough to affect Wall Street. I saw actually some reference to why Amoco's stock wasn't higher, and they said they were concerned about the price of PTA in the Far East. So if your product, one product can have that kind of an impact on the Wall Street market, I think it does.
Each year, the editor of the New York Times Book Review publishes at year-end a list of the 100 books considered to be most significant that were published during that year. At the end of 1996, just a couple of months ago, the editor included among them a book by John Horgan, The End of Science, it was called. And the one-sentence summary of the book was given, a bracing argument by a science journalist that the best and biggest discoveries are behind us. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's not a new thought. I kind of remember how many years ago, but it's been maybe 25 years ago that one of our vice presidents from Amoco Oil said that about the science for refining. And then continuous hydroforming came along after that. And we were just lucky we had some technology that worked. I think that the easy discoveries in science are probably have been made. Because discoveries come about by the identification for needs and opportunities. And then once you've got that, you can, the job is, well, it's not simple, but it's relatively easy to get from there to the scientific discovery that feeds those. And so the needs and opportunities have pretty well been identified. So from that standpoint, yes. But I think there are still scientific discoveries that are needed. I know just a few years ago there were needs to improve the speed of computer calculations, and it was dependent on developing the right kind of materials, and they had defined in some general terms those kinds of materials, and people were working very hard at doing that. The volume of those materials wasn't going to be very large in terms of pounds, but if you could do it, you could make a lot of money. And so I think, you know, there are still going to be some inventions made. They're not going to be made in the numbers and the ease with which they were made back then. I think there's some technologies that are producing commercial products now on a large scale that aren't, in my opinion, very good. And there's opportunity for people to improve those technologies. You don't always...
Would you like some coffee?
No, thank you. You don't always know whether or not you can do it. And but I think there's that it can be done. For instance, butane oxidation of molybdenum hydride is a fairly low chemical yield process. 60-65 mole per cent. There's opportunity for somebody to develop a catalytic system that I think will take that up to 90%, and that would really improve the technology, because basically it's a big heat exchanger, the reactor, because you burn so much as you generate so much heat that you got to get the heat taken out. Whereas if you got the selectivity down, you burn a lot less, you create a lot less energy from the heat. And it would just be a great improvement all the way around in making that product. There are a few products left like that, but not many. So I agree that a lot of the commercial scientific discoveries have been made, but there's still a lot left. I think one other thing that people like that may forget is that there is a finite supply of oil and gas, and it's probably going to last through the lifetime of most people that are living now. But sometime, maybe by the end of the next century, we may need to make products from stuff other than oil and gas, chemicals. How do you do that from natural products, which is where I think it's going to have to come from? And how do you do it in a way that is not going to totally disrupt the economics of the world at that time? So I think there will be opportunities for scientific discoveries in the future. I can't, you know, you never know exactly what they're going to be or how they're going to come about. But I don't think the last scientific discovery has been made.
You retired from Amoco, I believe, in 92?
Yes.
And you received the Perkin Medal 2 years later.
Yep.
What impact on you did receiving the Perkin Medal have, since it came after your career had terminated?
Well, I was talking to somebody in the past year, I guess, and I said, you know, I said, I really had had it fortunate. I said, I got recognized by the company, which is probably nice because you're recognized by the people that you work for and with and so on, and it's really nice to have that. And then I said, I was recognized by the U.S. government. I said, boy, that's thrilling and exciting. I was recognized by the college I went to because they gave me an honorary doctorate degree, and then finally I was recognized by the industry I worked on. I said you just can't hardly come off any better than that. You got recognition from everybody that really was important to me in my life. So I think it was a final recognition that was something that I really appreciated.
Certainly a remarkable record of recognition, as well as a remarkable record of industrial achievement that you had.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you, you made reference a few times in the discussions about your family, but tell me more specifically about your family. You have a wife and 5 children, you said. What are your children doing?
Let's see.
Give me their names and what they're doing.
The oldest son, Kurt, is kind of a computer jack, I guess. He's as near as I understand it, he's a computer programmer now working on accounting type technologies. My second son has a degree in chemistry and works for it was Union Oil Company, but I'm not sure he's still that, because they're in the process of selling their refinery operations. But anyhow, he's working for that company, selling oil products, lubricating oils and that sort of thing. My third son is a chemical engineer, works for Petrolite Corporation as general manager of their Bayport plant down in Texas. So he's essentially the head of their manufacturing operations, although they do have some in England that he doesn't have responsibility for. And our fourth son, Mike, is an aerospace engineer, works for NASA at Lewis Laboratories in Cleveland. His last responsibility was testing major rocket engines at for Lockheed out at their proving grounds in Sandusky. And our youngest child, a daughter, is teaching school out in California.
High school or grade?
Yes, she's freshman, teaching freshmen, juniors in high school in English.
Well, it sounds as though your family accomplishments merit praise as well as your professional accomplishments. Is there anything else you think of that needs to go on the tape to give a summary of your career?
Well, I think it would be incomplete not to give my wife credit for putting up with me. I had a tendency to get a little emotional about things and worry about them, and she was the person who kept bringing me back to earth when I was too exuberant or down. She was there to level me up, and I think even though she never understood much about chemistry, she always acted like she was interested, even though I think sometimes she was totally bored. And she allowed me to talk on and on about things that were bothering me.